of law school, baby. It all starts here.
Caleb Parsons is 6'9", swinging 80 to shoot the 30.
Game over, season over. The dude is dead.
What? It's unbelievable.
Hello and welcome to the Alligator Sports Podcast. This is the show for Friday, April 10th, 2009. I'm Adam Berry, the assistant sports editor and softball beat writer for Alligator Sports. And joining me today are...
Mike McCall, football beat writer and columnist.
Kyle Maestri, baseball beat writer.
Bobby Colovey, baseball beat writer.
All right, we got a lot to talk about today, but we're going to start off, we're going to clarify some comments Kyle made last week about spring practice that some people may have taken offense to, some people in this room perhaps. So Kyle, go ahead and clarify what you said last week about spring practice.
Well, I have a feeling I'm about to be attacked mercilessly on air, which I didn't know about previous to this. This is quite the ambush, but I just want to clarify, I'm sorry if this wasn't clear in the past, any colleagues or listeners of the podcast, that it's not spring practice itself that I have a problem with. You'd be foolish not to have spring practice if you're an NCAA football program. It obviously helps the kids develop. It helps the kids learn the offense, the defense, whatever schemes you're trying to put in. It helps them learn how to be college athletes in a low-pressure situation, and it helps guys get better who are fighting for spots. As a team, it makes all the sense in the world, and I, of course, don't think that they shouldn't have it. But what I do have a problem with is all the media coverage and fanfare that goes along with it, because it's essentially useless. It's pretty much useless to say a guy's hurt right now and he's going to miss 4 weeks. That, like, 4 weeks of what exactly? Because if he's been a player here, he's been a player in the program. If he's an athlete at all, that's not going to hurt his chances of playing come August and come the start of the season. So I don't like the extensive coverage. I don't like the things being blown out of proportion that may happen. I don't want to have people come back to me worried about Tebow because he doesn't look so hot under center. Like, that, I don't like the getting worked up about things, and I think the fanfare is a little much. So that's my stance officially on spring practice.
A lot of injuries that you don't really care about. Like, if they say Spikes, Tebow's hurt for 4 weeks, it doesn't matter because they have a job. But when it comes to the wide receivers and offensive linemen, where there are battles going on for positions, it matters a lot for who's hurt now, because right now they're fighting for their jobs, and they're possibly establishing themselves as the starters for next season.
Okay, that's a reasonable point. Your logic is obviously good there. But my point is that everyone's not even in camp who's going to be fighting for jobs. Guys like Andre DeBose, who are freshmen that are going to come in and make an impact, who didn't, you know, go ahead and enroll early, they're not even there to fight for jobs. And you can't tell me DeBose isn't going to get a job because he's not at spring practice. You can't tell me Jeff Demps isn't going to be on the same level as Chris Rainey because he's out running track. That's just not true.
Yeah, well, here's something else you need to think about when it comes to injuries. Like, for example, with the Pouncies being out on the offensive line, not a huge deal, right, because the season's so far away, they'll get healthy. But here's why it's a big deal. With Marquise Pouncey out, Sam Roby's been playing center, which never would have happened had this not come about. And with him getting snaps with the first team, he started to impress the coaches. When Marquise Pouncey came back to practice this week, he went to guard, not center. So Sam Roby could be taking over the center position. That's huge. That's all because of an injury. That would otherwise not mean anything. If he goes back to center, Marquise Pouncey goes back to guard, where he was a freshman All-American, I think, freshman All-Conference at least. They have depth problems on the line, and center is one of those positions where there was no competition if Marquise Pouncey isn't hurt. So it opens up a lot of things, and you can see a lot of things happen. And I mean, here, I think the fanfare is ridiculous, too. I mean, when I listened to the podcast the other night, I thought you were saying spring practice should be, like, abolished.
No,
obviously,
not
that's not what you mean.
Yeah.
But, like, I think the orange and blue game is a total joke. It's really blown out of proportion. It's just a scrimmage. Like, 50,000 people are coming to watch a scrimmage. I mean, I begged out of covering that last year.
But,
and then at practice on Wednesday, the whole, like, all the way down the side of the field was packed with people. And that's a lot. But my problem with that is, a couple weeks ago, when we were talking, I don't know if it was on air or not, we were talking about how ridiculous it is for, like, Tebow in town, and how people are always running up to him and how crazy it is. And you were saying, well, that's what fans do. That's what, like, supposed to happen. It's what they're supposed to do. Like, is this not what fans are supposed to do? I mean, they're watching a team that's projected to win a national championship. Is it not okay for them to be crazy about this?
I mean, it's okay. I don't think it's wrong or anything. They're doing anything, like, wrong, or they should be reprimanded or anything. I just think there's 100 million better things I can think to do with my time than go out, wait outside the practice field and watch the players come out and maybe get, you know, kind of sign a couple autographs or whatever they're going to do. I actually think the orange and blue game is really cool, and if I was a fan, I'd rather go to that. If I was a media person, I wouldn't want to cover that as opposed to maybe the daily, like, beat work. But if I'm a fan, I'm going to watch something. I'd rather watch the guys, like, compete with each other, go at each other in a game atmosphere where, you know, points are being scored and stuff like that, and check that stuff out rather than, you know, drills and stuff that they may be doing in the daily workouts.
The biggest thing for spring practice to me is that in the fall you have 2-3 weeks before you start preparing for a game. You need to already know who's going to be starting for you or have an idea of who you want to be starting for you. So whether or not there's the people who aren't in camp yet, it's kind of their fault for not trying harder to get there when they know how big of an advantage it is to be there early. So for me, you need to establish yourself as a starter going into fall in spring practice. And that's what these guys are doing now. And then fall practice, they're going to have to do it again. They're going to have to establish, they're going to have to maintain what they did in spring practice, or they're going to lose the job to the newcomers. But the newcomers, especially now with how everything's going on in college football, you have to realize that if you want a starting job in the fall, you're going to have to try to be here in the spring. And you got to start realizing that, you know, as a junior in high school, and start adjusting to that early.
What you just said about wanting to go to the spring game because you can, like, see things happen like a game atmosphere, it's the same way at spring practice. I mean, they end every practice with goal line drills. Saturdays are scrimmage days where it's the same kind of game atmosphere. They keep track of points, and the losers have to do all kinds of punishments like push-ups and sit-ups and whatever. And you also get to watch hitting drills, which is really interesting to me. You're getting to see these guys go at each other in, like, circle of life drills and things like that. They're just beating the crap out of each other. And you get to see fights, which I love. Nothing beats a fight. And you're not going to see that at the orange and blue game, and probably not at a game unless they're playing Miami. But the other day in practice, I mean, Carlos Dunlop went off on somebody. I don't even know who it was.
It was Marcus Gilbert.
Marcus Gilbert.
Looking up some pictures.
And Brandon Antoine, who's coming off a torn ACL, had to restrain, like, the biggest freak of an athlete on the team. I mean, that's all fun to watch, and it's more of, like, an intimate way to see the team. I mean, you're seeing what they do behind closed doors, except the doors are open. I mean, you get to see how the coaches try to motivate their players in practice. You get to see which coaches have the dirtiest mouths, Dazio. I mean, it's really fun to watch. You get to see things you would never see otherwise. That's what I like about it.
Yeah, there are definitely some things that are, like, cool or redeeming about watching a spring practice. I just don't think it outweighs, like, a number of any other things. I'd rather go watch the baseball game. I'd rather go watch Preston Tucker hit 3 home runs and have 11 RBIs than stand outside, like, the huge mob of people that I thought, maybe they'll go check out the baseball game when they're done getting some autographs that didn't matriculate over to the baseball field. So I think the point about that Bobby made about athletes, they need to try harder to get here in the spring, is really not fair. Like, I kind of agree with him. Like, in principle, obviously you'd want more time to practice with the team and impress the coaches. But, like, it's not like they're not doing anything right now. They're still in high school. They're trying to graduate from high school. For a lot of them, graduating from high school is a big deal and, like, means something and is not easy to do. High school maybe came easily to all of us, but not necessarily to everybody out there. So, and also the other point I wanted to make is that there are, like McCall said, there are redeeming things about spring practice, but as a consumer of sports information, like, when I'm out there surfing the web or I'm taking my daily dose of what's going on in sports, this ranks, like, just below the cricket match today. I don't know, like, that's obviously an exaggeration, but it's not something that's on top of my list. Baseball's on the top of my list. NBA's on the top of my list. Things like that are things that I want to read and I want to listen to, not necessarily spring practice.
Yeah, but, I mean, you got to consider, like, all right, for you, maybe, but we're in Gainesville, and we're in a town that is so obsessed with one team that it's unreal.
Okay, well,
so
I'm just defending myself.
Okay,
here.
but if you want to go, like, to get at, like, the heart of what, you know, people think about spring practice, you have to go at the heart of, like, people liking the Florida football team. Because this is just a natural...
I understand it all. I just disagree. I'm not saying that I don't understand what's going on or why this happens. I'm just saying that I don't agree with it.
So do you disagree with people being obsessed with Florida football? Like,
to the point where they come out and watch a million spring practices? Probably, yeah. I think that's maybe a little too much.
I mean, they find...
It's not wrong, it's just too much for me. I wouldn't be able to follow a team like that.
Okay, but I think it's, like, perfectly fair for people to like Florida football more than, like, Major League Baseball.
No, absolutely.
Florida baseball.
Definitely. It is completely fair for the Florida Gators to be their favorite team. Out of any team, out of anything they do. It could be their favorite hobby to go to Florida events and stuff like that. I would just never get to the point with any sports team like that.
I just want to come back to, we were talking about the media coverage of a little earlier. You know, like, the big issues, some stuff that's come out of spring practice this year has been, like, the I-form stuff with Moody. I mean, does that affect the team in the fall at all?
Steve Adazio is a new offensive coordinator, and he's more of an old-school type guy. Things are changing. I mean, it's still Urban Meyer's offense. They're still running the spread, but you can tell Steve Adazio's, like, marks on the program already. I mean, they're moving under center. There's also something trying to help Tebow's draft stock, and same thing with John Brantley when they're trying to get to the NFL. But, I mean, these are big changes that are being put in place in the spring, and it's important. I mean, you're going to see right now they're trying to figure out if they can run the I-form or not. They don't have enough tight ends. The fullbacks are finally starting to come around a little bit. I mean, if you've been out of practice, you've seen T.J. Pridemore do some things that he was definitely not doing the first couple of days. He's actually kind of involved in the passing game. He's blocking a lot better. He's not getting screamed at, and he's not getting blasted by Urban Meyer after practice. So things are getting better with the fullbacks, and this is the time for them to figure out if they can run the I form. If they do, it'll be because they're succeeding now in spring practice. If they don't, it's because they're not succeeding right now in spring practice.
Admittedly, I've not been to a single spring practice, but I will put money on the table right now that the I form is not run this season in any meaningful situation. Maybe goal line. Maybe goal line they put in a package. But there's no chance they run the I form. You heard Urban Meyer say they're not going to run the I form, and he's calling the shots last time I checked. And I think Heifer wrote a story for our sports reporting class that I hope we can run in the paper if it's good enough about Brantley and how the I-form stuff and bringing in Loeffler and all that kind of quarterback taking the snap under center is going to benefit Brantley perhaps more than it benefits Tebow, which I completely agree with. I don't think you're going to see Tebow be rendered, you know, 80% of what Tebow actually is by sticking him in the I-form and sticking him under center when he's going to be clearly much more effective in the spread. He's the definition of a spread quarterback. If you could pick one guy to run the spread for you this year, it's going to be Tim Tebow. He's proven that he can be great in the spread offense. So I just think that the I-form stuff is definitely not for this year. Maybe they want to get a look with Brantley and what it's going to look like. And maybe they owed it to Tebow to at least try, hey, you're going to come back for us. We appreciate that. We want to help your draft stock if we can. So at least you can put this on your resume. But it's not going to be run this year in meaningful situations.
If they actually are switching to or putting in some I-form just because they think it's going to add another dimension to the offense and make them even harder to stop, I'm okay with that. But if they're doing it just because they feel they owe it to Tebow to run some I formation and mess with what they did last year, it's foolish in my opinion, because that's just hurting the team and, you know, for the safety of Tebow making the NFL easier. But
you're as informed as anybody sitting here, and especially on football. So what do you think? Which do you think it is? I'm curious to hear your opinion.
I really do think, because I think it is just for Tebow, because
okay,
especially because he keeps it how he said they don't have fullbacks, they don't have enough tight ends. You know, going in, whether or not you have enough tight ends, you have enough fullbacks, and you only have one I-form type running back to be running a formation like this, you don't think, hey, maybe we could try to run this, you know, unless you're thinking, hey, this is going to help out our boy Tebow. So I think that's the only reason, really, that they're running it. I know Steve Adagio is a throwback type coach, but in, you know, he knows that this, what we have right now, is not I formation. It's spread, guys, and it's worked last year. It worked in 2006. It worked somewhat in 2007, but I mean, it worked. The offense worked great in 2007. So they're not going to mess with the spread unless there is some other, you know, motive behind it.
Here's the motive right here. They can't run the exact same thing they ran last year. They lose Percy Harvin. You can't run the exact same offense you just ran when people have seen it for a whole year. You got to add a wrinkle. You've got an offensive coordinator, like you said, who's more old school. So the wrinkle they're going to throw in is probably going to be his idea, because Urban Meyer's already got all his wrinkles in the system. He's bringing in something different. It's not just to help Tebow's NFL stock. That's a byproduct of it. Now, I think hiring Scott Loeffler was not just to help Tebow. It's not like Scott Loeffler's not a good quarterbacks coach and he won't help everyone else who comes through here. That's part of it. That's part of the motivation. But that's not the whole motivation for the I-form. What Meyer always says is you run the offense. You don't run an offense and fit players into it. You run an offense for your players.
Right.
So they're trying the I-form out. If it doesn't work, if
they don't have the players for it. He said they don't.
He said they don't. And then this week, if you've been there, he talked about how things are getting better with the positions they have. Des Parks' injury isn't as serious as they thought. It's just a kneecap dislocation, not a ligament injury. So he might be able to come back. And he said he's been praising the fullbacks, like, nonstop. So the fullbacks are going to even fill some of the tight end roles this year.
My big problem is that you say it adds a new wrinkle. The I-formation is nothing new. There's not too many things new out of the I-formation that you can do from it. People know what the I-formation is. They know how to stop the I-formation. And especially with, you know, not the highest talent of guys for this type of formation, teams know how to stop it.
That's the best counter-argument any of us have made in this whole debate, because you're saying that they need something new that's going to catch defenses off guard. Going to the I-form is the exact opposite of that. Urban Meyer has a really dynamic offense in place, and I agree that you have to adjust for losing Percy Harvin, and you're right that they can't do the exact same things that they did last year, but the way to solve that is definitely not by going to the I-form. It's by Taylor, you know, tweaking the spread to your players. They have spread players. Their quarterback's a spread quarterback. Their running backs, for the most part, are spread running backs. They have quick guys on the outside you can get the ball to. You know, they also have possession-type guys, I know. But they're much better suited for the spread.
That's true. They are much better suited for the spread. But it's not like if they run the I-form, it's going to be Emmanuel Moody, 15 carries, and then go back to the spread or something. They're going to do different things with the spread. They do different things with every offense.
So what do you think they will do with the I this year?
I don't know. I have no idea. I haven't known what they're going to do with any offense, but it always turns out pretty well. I mean, I trust that if they're going to run the I form, it's not just to showcase Tebow's drop back passing. They're going to run it because they know it can be successful. Urban Meyer would not put an offense into his team just to help Tebow drop back passing. That's asinine. That's definitely not what's happening.
No, but they would work with him, I think, on it in practice and in spring practice when it doesn't really mean anything, so that at least he can say, hey, I've worked in the I form a little bit. We didn't use it too much. Maybe we used it in 30-point blowouts here and there, or maybe we used it on the goal line a couple times, but it was never a situation where he was operating primarily out of the I form, or if ever in meaningful situations. I just don't see it at all.
The main things I could see this actually working is if they came out and no one got set and everyone just audibled positions and got into the I form, got out of the I form, and really messed with the defense's mind. That might work. Also, if no one ever found out that they were practicing the I formation and they just threw it out against LSU and LSU's defense had no clue really how to like switch it up, that might throw teams off. But if teams go into a game knowing the I formation and they line up in an I formation, there are only certain, like, so many things you can do out of it. You can hand the ball off. You can do a pitch. Maybe some, like, you know, power options and stuff like that. Maybe a play action. Otherwise, you're just dropping back and throwing or handing the ball off. There's really not too many things to do out of it that's going to surprise too many teams.
I was going
to
say that's the irony of them, you know, like sneaking the I form into the offense, is that it's sort of like the biggest story of this spring practice, you know, media overexposure, as I might consider it. Do we have anything?
That's definitely true. There's been a lot of talk about the I form, but it's not like it's like a charade they're trotting out to distract people. I mean, that's not the case at all. And like you said, they move into a lot of different formations when they're on the field. They do all kinds of shifting before the snap. That's a great idea. That's the exact kind of thing they should use the I form for. But it's not like when you're preparing for Florida, it's not like teams are going to like dedicate a day to stopping Florida's like I form package. And if that pops up in a game in any situation, it's not going to be like the most natural response to defend.
But you don't have to like really prepare too much for an I formation, because they've seen it before. They can just say, hey, you see the I formation, you know what to do. Like, it's not like, oh, how do we stop an I formation? Like, do we need to watch the guard? Do we need to, you know, keep eye on one of the slot receivers? You know how to stop an I formation. And not too many teams run like a very special type of I formation where there's a lot of trick packages. So it's not something you have to prepare so much for as just keep an eye out for the I formation. If you see it, adjust how we normally, you know, play the I formation.
But I mean, by that token, you can just adjust to the spread when you play Florida.
But
I mean, it doesn't.
The spread has so many more things you can do out of the spread. And Bobby can talk about this way better than me, but the options that you have coming out of the spread, where the ball can go and who can touch it, who can carry it, is infinitely more complex than the I form.
Not only is there so many more options, but the Gators have so much more speed than everyone else that you can say, all right, play how we want for the I form. And they can't, because the Gators are faster than them. And they run it so efficiently that teams can't. That's why it's worked so well. Because teams, you're going to tell me that teams didn't know they were going to run the spread last year. They didn't know they were going to run in 2007. Teams knew it. They just can't stop it because they run it so well. And they have so many guys perfect for the system that they know what to do with it.
But getting back to the original argument, are you saying that it's not important that they're running the I form in spring practice? Or what was the point of that?
Important to who?
Well, what were you saying? What was your point about it?
Yeah, I think that they're not – my original thought on the I form was that I would put money down right now that the I forms never run in meaningful situations next year, except for perhaps on the goal line.
Wasn't it notable then that they're just, like, wasting time in spring practice?
Sure.
On a formation that I can use?
Yeah.
I mean, there's very notable things that come out of spring practice. It's worth
coming. But I think this is a long-term investment, too. I think when Brantley takes over – that's what I was saying. I was praising D for his thing that he wrote that I hope we can get in the paper, is that I think it's a long-term investment. You start running it now, these guys are going to be here, you know, for a couple of years to come. Some of them aren't. But, you know, you're going to get Brantley more snaps, more comfortable with it. The longer you can put it in, then, you know, the better for the players.
And the big thing is, long-term-wise, every year the Gators miss out on that big running back recruit. And that's because no one wants to come here as a running back. If all of a sudden you see they're running the I some, maybe that big running back's like, all right, I'll go, and I'm going to establish that we're not running too much spread this year because I'm here. We're running the I formation because as long as I'm touching the ball, the team's going to win. So big, and especially because a lot of high school recruits, especially the top ones, little big-headed, they think they can change an entire program and be the star. So, I mean, Trent Richardson, they missed out this year. They missed out on, I can't remember who was the year before that. They've missed out on C.J. Spiller. They've just continuously missing that big running back. And they brought in Emmanuel Moody, who's going to probably would benefit the most from this I formation because he's the only back that can really run it, like pound the ball up the middle. If you see Jeff Dempsey there, or if you see Chris Rainey, much as I like them and I think they can run up the middle a little bit, you need it much more spread out. They're going to be bouncing it out. They're going to be getting tosses. They're going to be running. They're going to be running the options. So the only back that's going to be pounding up the middle is going to be Emmanuel Moody or I guess Tebow, which you can't really do too much out of the eye.
Yeah, that's a great point by Bobby. Obviously, like it helps recruiting infinitely for that type of running back that they haven't been able to land. And, like, even if they're not, you know, arrogantly thinking, hey, I can change the program or I want to be the face of the program, which I'm not ruling out. There are those guys out there. But every guy wants the ball. That's just natural. If you tell me I can go to Alabama and I can get 20 carries a game, or I can go to Florida and I can get 7 a game, I can't blame a guy for going to a place where he's going to touch the ball twice as much and be the guy. That's obvious to me, and I don't blame any of the recruits for that.
I was actually talking to Defer today, Mike DeFernando. And he was talking about how he wrote a story about Emmanuel Moody. He likes Moody. And I said, Emmanuel Moody made the wrong decision by coming here. I still think he's a really good back. And if he did more research about different schools who would fit his style, he would be good. Because he's the type of guy that's going to get you 6, 4, 3, 7, 4, 3, 2, 1 type yardage. And throughout 20 carries over a game, he's going to be close to 100 yards. And you'll be like, wow. He did a great job. But when he's only getting 5, 6 carries, and like, oh, he only got 25 yards. Whereas Chris Rainey, Jeff Dempsey, they need one carry, and all of a sudden they've got a 100-yard game. That's the difference between them. I think Emmanuel Moody, if he went to a different school and could, you know, actually play and get those 20 touches, everyone would be like, Emmanuel Moody is an NFL-type back.
Do you think putting in the I-form is like a way to use Moody? Like they're trying to like get him the ball more, making an effort
and
for it?
I don't think they're doing anything to really get Emmanuel Moody more involved. They seem very low on him coming off last year, and I mean, I think even if they went to I-form, they're still not getting him enough touches. It's something that if they go into I-form, they got to use Emmanuel Moody, and he's going to be the most efficient guy, but they're still not going to give him enough touches. We're like, wow, Emmanuel Moody, you had a great game.
This is going to come off like hyperbole, maybe a little, like, seems unrealistic. This is honestly how I feel. But Bobby just, you know, illustrated how a guy like Moody's going to wear down the defense. Like, he's going to wear down the defense the whole game. They're going to be tired, and then they're going to bust a couple in the fourth quarter, and that's how teams like that win games, by wearing down the defense. At Florida, they don't waste their time wearing down the defense. There's no reason to get in there, get somebody 20 carries a game, and then wait until the defense is tired. They're so much faster and more athletic than the other teams they're playing for the most part, that they can hit big plays throughout the course of the game without wearing anyone down.
I think you're forgetting like what this team was like before like the LSU game last year. Tebow up the middle was like a staple. I mean, that was how the offense started usually most of the games. Tebow up the middle just pounding, pounding, pounding.
But if I'm not mistaken, everyone was criticizing the offense because they were doing that, and they weren't, you know, actually producing like they're supposed to. All of a sudden, they started opening up the offense and scoring quicker. No one cares about those first few games where the offense looked bad. They looked bad those games. There's a reason why they looked bad.
And Tebow's numbers were down last year for the season, like in pretty much every respect. And it's because they had so many different options and so many guys making plays at all times. They had so many different playmakers to go to that they didn't have a year ago. And yeah, there were times when it became, it's crunch time, we got to give the ball to Percy Harvin because he's obviously your best guy. But the Tebow up the middle stuff and the Tebow carrying the ball 20 times a game definitely started to fade out as the season went on.
But it's not like that's necessarily gone. I mean, we don't know until we see them take the field this season and what they're doing.
It would be a mistake for them to revert to that.
Right, it absolutely would. Right. But it's not like they can't give Emmanuel Moody the ball like up the middle. It's not like that.
Well,
they will now and then.
They're not going to dedicate the game plan to giving Emmanuel Moody the ball up the middle. They're not going to do that. There's way too many other options, too many explosive options for them to dedicate it to one guy who's pounding the ball, especially when they have a quarterback that can also do it.
Right. They're never going to pound. You're never going to see a guy get, like, every carry on a possession. That doesn't happen here. But you still saw lots of times, even when things were going well last year, where possessions would start with, like, Rainey and Demps up the middle. That never made sense to me. I know they're, like, quick in the middle and they can make cuts behind linemen, but it never worked out.
It did work out a lot of times because if you watch the run started up the middle, then they're bounced out. One of the big things they did last year is they really spread out the offensive linemen, and once you spread that out, those smaller guys can get through those holes really easily and make those big plays. They're not going to do that type of stuff with Emmanuel Moody. They're going to keep things a little bit more tighter, if anything, and try to get him just pound right through the middle. So, I mean, they're not going to dedicate him. Tebow will resort back to running the ball up the middle and tucking the ball and running when things are in a crunch situation and things are, he doesn't know where else to go except for put the team on his back and run.
And no one's saying Emmanuel Moody's not a good player. I think me and Bobby both think Emmanuel Moody's a good player. In a system that works for him, he'd be very effective. I don't think Emmanuel Moody's a bad player, just that with the offense that they run and the type of options that they have, there's no chance that they're going to game plan for a big SEC game and say, okay, we got to get the ball in Emmanuel's hands 10 to 15 times today. And I think they will do that for other guys, and they have done that for guys in the past.
I also remember today, if I'm not mistaken, it was you that Emmanuel Moody told that when he first got here and was transferring, couldn't play, he said, next year, when I'm playing, we'll win a national championship. Sure, it wasn't because of him, but they won that national championship that he guaranteed.
He made good
on his promise.
Look, the bottom line is Meyer's going to do what he's always done, and that's take the players he has, evaluate them, and get them the ball in ways that they can be successful.
Right.
The way for Emmanuel Moody to be successful is to carry the ball up the middle. And while the offense will never be based on that, it's not like he's not going to get carries.
Your first part of that was completely right. He's going to take the talent that he has, he's going to evaluate the players, and he's going to adjust to the offense because Urban Meyer's great at that. And when he does that, he will see that Emmanuel Moody is the only guy on the team who's going to benefit from going to pounding the ball at the middle in the I formation, and he's not going to go to that. He's smarter than that.
If they use the I, they will use Emmanuel Moody because that's the guy they've got. But they're not going to run the I, be like, oh, the best way to use Emmanuel Moody is to run the I formation because that's not going to help the team like overall because Emmanuel Moody is only going to be picking up 3, 4, 5 yards a carry. People, they're not going to want to see that. They're not going to dedicate themselves, which is what you have to do in the I formation. You can't just run it sparingly. You have to dedicate the offense to the I formation if you want to pound the ball with a back, and that's what Emmanuel Moody can do. He can run the ball up the middle in the I formation. So if they want to use his talent and they use it in the I formation, they can't just dedicate it for a couple plays. They got to do it for
It's not just the I formation we're talking about. It's just giving Emmanuel Moody the ball up the middle, which is, I mean, you can still pound the ball up the middle on the spread if you want. I mean, you can still give a guy carries up the middle.
Then why waste the time with all the I formation stuff?
I just think they're trying out something different, something they think they can be successful with a new offensive coordinator. I mean, it's not like rocket science.
All right. Well, we obviously don't agree on this topic. I just wanted to say the last point that Bobby said. Do you feel like, I kind of feel this way, I don't know if you can think this way too, that if you're primarily an I team and you throw the spread out there every once in a while, that's a change of pace thing. That's something where you get a ton of looks. I feel like if you're a spread team and you throw the I form every once in a while, you're almost giving the defense a rest. Like, you're limiting the things you can do, and it's like, okay, they can't hurt us too bad right now.
The biggest thing is that if you throw out the spread real quick, you're now having teams either they're going to be have a third linebacker, and that linebacker is not going to be able to stay with that third and fourth receiver, so you're really – you know, you're really limited on what you can do defensively, or you got to really make quick changes on defense, get some nickel, get a dime guy in there. And if you do that if you go from spread to I, it's a lot easier to get one linebacker in than it is to find like a good cornerback who's going to be able to, you know, at least one good cornerback, and probably one of the linebackers is going to have to do some coverage against a wide receiver, which is never want you to see. It's an awful mismatch. And teams can take advantage of it. So it is easier to go from I to spread, although a lot of teams who dedicate themselves to I's don't really have enough wide receivers with that type of talent to do it. So you can catch a player off guard, but you only want to do it a couple times a game because you just don't have the talent for it usually. And one more thing about, you know, the I formation, they have so few of guys who can actually run the I formation that their backup, but one of the guys who's been getting the most carries is this walk-on named Christopher Scott, who's an I-formation type back. He's went to Santa Fe for like 2.5 years and then transferred over to UF and walked onto the football team. So that just kind of shows you how little of guys they have, you know, made for the I-formation.
All right, now let's move on to one more football thing here. McCall, tell us about this new recruit, Gideon Ajagbe. I think we're pronouncing it. Go ahead and tell us about him.
Yeah, Florida picked up a commitment from Gideon Ajagbe, who's from Ransom Everglades High, which is a very interesting high school name, I thought, in Miami. It's actually located in Coconut Grove right on the bay, so it's very scenic and beautiful. I Google mapped it.
It's very nice. That's a good area.
I suggest you do the same. So anyway, Gideon Ajagbe, he's like a 4-star player on Rivals. I don't think he has a position rating yet. He's also, I think, listed as a safety on a few sites, but he's expected to play linebacker here. He's not that big. I guess he's fast, right? Is he supposed to be fast?
I assume so. There's not been too much on him. He's one of those guys that a lot of teams haven't heard about him, but now that he's a Florida commit, you can expect his ratings just to go soaring up just because he committed to Florida.
So anyway, Ajagbe is the 9th commit so far for Florida's 2010 class, which doesn't mean anything since they don't sign until like February 3rd of next year. But what's significant about Ajagbe is that if he signs, He'll be the first player in 5 years from Dade County to sign with Florida. It's amazing that Florida's been able to win two national championships in 3 years without pulling players out of one of the most talent-rich counties in the country that's in their state.
One of the biggest problems is that they're competing against the University of Miami. And those kids grew up all Hurricane fans. They all want to go to Miami. And once they get, you know, just one phone call from whoever the head coach is at the time, those kids are flying, going to Miami. They're probably on campus every single week making unofficial visits and hanging out with all the players. Or by the time they're ready to sign, those that boys, they're ready to go and be part of the U.
I think they've competed pretty well for conflicting players who were splitting between the two schools who weren't from Miami. Like, you see them land a guy like Major Wright or Matt Patchen who could have went either way. So they've done pretty well that way, but I think, yeah, Bobby's right, just it's so ingrained in the culture, it's really tough. And I wanted to also throw out a question, like, don't we think the rating system is so backwards the way you explained it sometimes, where, like, a guy's a 4-star and has no ranking, he commits to Florida, and then all of a sudden his ranking rises?
Yeah,
like, that alone,
that's
backwards
reason.
To me.
He's a good recruit because he committed to Florida, but he's, you know.
Yeah, I just read a book called Meat Market all about Ed Orgeron's second year as the head coach of Ole Miss, right, and the whole recruiting process. And just to show how ridiculous it was, there was this one kid that they were recruiting that went to Auburn, or committed to Auburn, then decommitted from Auburn and lost a star. And then there was a kid they had committed that was a 3-star, and then started talking to LSU and Auburn, and they went up a star. So just because they talked to these better schools, all of a sudden, they're better in the eyes of scouts. Most of these scouts probably don't know too much about what these coaches are actually looking for. They just know, hey, this is a freak who's doing big things in high school and he's talking to all these coaches. He's got to be really good.
Yeah, I mean, in their defense, though, it's a very inexact science, and they're trying
mm-hmm.
to, like, cover a whole, like, nation full of high school kids who still have a lot of developing to do. But anyway, getting back to the Dade County thing, I remember when I covered recruiting, I guess, for the signing class of 2007, there was a kid I was really excited about, Armando Allen, who's a running back from Hialeah down in Dade County. And then also DeMarcus Van Dyke, who's a cornerback, also from Miami, yeah. And Armando and DeMarcus were both supposed to commit on the same day. And I guess the night before, Armando Allen found out that he could get into, like, the engineering program at Notre Dame or something, and that he called off his announcement, and then DeMarcus Van Dyke called his off also. He ended up going to Miami. Allen's at Notre Dame. I mean, that's just – things fall apart so much for Florida with Dade kids. Like, they have to go through all the way with him, or else, like, they're not going to get him. You can't leave, like, anything to chance. You almost have to grab them on signing day so they don't have time to change their mind.
I mean, I can't say anything negative about a guy like Allen who's choosing to go to school because of some kind of academic portion where if he wanted to be an engineer, he can get into the engineering program at Notre Dame. I mean, you can't say, oh, well, that's a dumb decision. Don't you know how much better UF is at football than Notre Dame? Because I'll never say anything negative about a kid who chooses academics. DVD, I'm assuming that his boys all around him were saying, why aren't you going to Miami and stuff like that, saying, you know, can't you just go to our backyard and make Miami good again? And he, of course, gave in, probably.
I mean, I can't say anything negative about either one of them. They both made whatever decision they thought was best for them at the time, and that's fine. You can never fault anyone for doing that. But, like, for example, in January when I was down in Miami covering, or, like, in the run-up to the BCS championship game, this came up a lot. And I was asking people, like, don't you think it's going to be good for Florida's recruiting that they're playing in a national championship here in Miami? They're very visible down here right now. This is like free recruiting. And they said, no, it's the opposite. Like, these kids down here grow up hating Florida. It's like ingrained in their culture. And they see them down here and they want them out. Like, and they don't want to see them succeed here. It just frustrates them. It makes them, you know, I guess want Miami to be even better than that. It's like, it has like the opposite reaction than you would think it would.
That's cool, though. I like that. Like, I think it's cool that they have a lot of guys at the U that, you know, come up wanting to be Canes their whole lives, and they're from the area, and they're local guys, and some local friends can go out and go to the games, and it's more of like a community-type thing. I'm cool with that. I think that's real cool. And, I mean, it's rough for recruiting for the Gators, obviously, but, you know, it's gonna work like that in college football, which is what's cool about college football.
That was one of the things. When the entire high school football team of Northwestern went from being the best high school football team in the whole nation in 2007, I guess. No, yeah, 2007. Then they all went to Miami. I think they ended up being like 8. And their whole goal was, we want to make Miami a national championship team again. And that's what type of dedication they have, and makes recruiting a lot easier on guys like Randy Shannon. You don't have to put much effort into those guys. They can just say, hey, come by, you know, hang out. And he can go try to get out-of-state guys and put a lot more effort into those type of guys.
I mean, Miami, to me, it's like you talked about the culture. I mean, to me, Miami and South Florida, I've only been there a couple of times. I know you guys live down there. It's not Florida to me. It's like a totally – it's what people associate with Florida. But if you go around the rest of the state, I mean, I live in Jacksonville. If you look at, like, Jacksonville, Gainesville, Tampa, Tallahassee, Orlando, the majority – Orlando's a little bit like South Florida. But for the most part, the state is not like Miami. It's not like South Florida. So they have – like this bubble down there, and Gainesville's like the country. Things are just too different.
It's all perspective, my friend, because I would argue that South Florida is the only Florida, and the rest of the state is not like Florida.
I just want to know what do you mean by there's such a big difference? What's the difference?
Well, Tallahassee, we can all write off as being part of Alabama, essentially. Like, it's that kind of like deep South culture that's like in the panhandle right there. Maybe, like, not the university, but, like, you know, the panhandle of Florida, I think, generally speaking, is a deep South culture.
With the experience I have living in Steinhatchee and having lived in the actual South, I'd say yes that a lot of North Florida is more like, you know, the deep South.
Not
the
Jacksonville.
Alabama's the Georgia. Not Jacksonville.
But Jacksonville's definitely the South. Jacksonville's one. There's a high school named after Nathan Bedford.
Yeah, a player. His name's Byron Jones. He's here. I covered recruiting when he committed. And when I found out that the school was called Nathan Bedford Forest, they now refer to it, I guess, just as Forest. But the fact that that has not changed is remarkable to me. Do people not know who Nathan Bedford Forrest is?
Actually,
and for those who don't, he is the starter of the KKK. And so, though, like, do they just not know that he started it, or do they just not, you know, care at all about it?
There's been an uproar about this. It's actually, I don't know if it's been officially changed, but on the Florida roster, Brandon Hicks is still listed as from Nathan Bedford Forrest High.
Well, to get away from the KKK talk, and you know more about Jacksonville than me. I guess I was thinking more Ponte Vedra, like where you're from area. But, you know, South Florida is not South in the way that the Deep South is the South. Like, it's south of the south of the country, if you can think of it like that. It's so south, it's north, because there's so many northerners that come down there.
I'm not sure how that started, that so many people from the north decided to move to South Florida.
Right.
But they're all there. I mean,
snowbirds.
And then once you get...
Just snowbirds, but, I mean, people who live there are... If you go around, they're like... Oh, like, where'd you move down from? And everyone's like, oh, I moved from New York. What part of New York? Brooklyn. Like, everyone, like, it's remarkable how many people my mom meets that went to the same high school as her and they're now living in Wellington, Florida.
And
it's just remarkable.
Another thing that's all about perspective, it's really funny because our friend Bobby Casey, who lives, like, Fort Lauderdale, Hollywood area, which is, like, an hour south of us in West Palm, he, like, says that he doesn't think of us as South Florida, like, the West Palm area as South Florida because, like, he's down closer to Miami. So it's just like all a perspective thing. It's kind of funny. And then Miami's a whole different ballgame altogether. So
yeah, and I mean, that's what we're really talking about is Miami, which is kind of, it's a much, first of all, it's a much bigger city than anything else. Even though Jacksonville's bigger in size, like Miami's like a way bigger city. And the whole culture, I mean, it's not the South. And then I would not, and I consider Florida as the South, even though most people don't, especially you guys living where you live.
Right.
But that's like just a totally different state almost on its own.
All right, so that was today's lesson in social geography. Let's move on. We're going to talk about the baseball
team. We're
going to
do economics next week, so come back.
All right, let's talk about Preston Tucker and the baseball team. You guys were there. He just went off the other night. Somebody start off. Tell us about Preston Tucker, Bobby.
You want to go? Because I mean, I'll go. I mean,
you can start.
From before the season, when we gave you guys a season preview, all we did was rave about how great
we being me and Bobby.
Yes,
of course.
People doubted us, and for the longest time, he's been hitting well, but he hadn't put up the power numbers. It started to come around this weekend and just exploded against Central Florida and went for three home runs, two of which were grand slams. The other one was a 3-run shot, which would have been a grand slam. Had Avery Barnes not ruined the fun and hit a sacrifice fly the bat before and drove in a run to take one guy off base.
Don't open up your calculators on the computer. That's 11 RBIs for everybody at home listening to this. And it was the most impressive thing I've ever watched in person, baseball-wise. I've never seen anything so impressive. His first home run was an absolute bomb that he pulled through right field that almost landed in Keys. It was so far. That was the first grand slam. Next time up, he takes it opposite field and over the left center field, left center field gap, pretty much hit the home run right there for a 3-run shot. So then we're hoping he gets to come up again because there's no cheering in the press box, but it doesn't matter. This kid could have been playing for UCF and everyone would have done the same things. It was just greatness. You just wanted to see greatness. And there was a guy on second and third and two outs, and Jonathan Pigott was hitting in front of him, and he gets down like 1-2 in the count or something, and then everyone's just like, God, let Jonathan Pigott get on base. So Tucker gets one more crack at this. and he draws a walk, and Tucker comes up, and Bobby's like, okay, not only is he going to hit a home run here, but he's going to hit it to center field. Because we have a running joke. Every time somebody hits a ball well to center field, I turn to Bob and say, they should never hit it to center field. No one ever hits the ball out there. It's 400 feet away. I've seen countless 380-foot bombs just get shagged like normal fly balls in center field. It's where home runs go to die, to be honest. And so Preston Tucker walks up, and all, you know, 1,000 fans or whatever it was that were there stood up and, like, started cheering. All the players come up to the top of the dugout. You could just feel it that, like, everyone expected him to hit a home run there. And for me, I feel like, God, that's – like, this kid's not – come on. Let's not get ridiculous with this kid. First pitch, he cranks a line drive over the center field wall. It was like a 420-foot line drive over center field, most well-hit ball I've ever seen. And it just capped his night. It was 3 home runs in 3 innings. I can't rave about it enough. The only thing I can compare it to that I've seen live is I accidentally caught a Rangers game in Arlington one time when A-Rob was playing there with my aunt. And I don't know if you people out there remember, but there was a game where on his birthday he hit 2 home runs and one was a walk-off grand slam in extra innings.
Yeah.
And that was incredibly impressive to me. This surpassed that, and I was at both of those games. So take that for what it's worth.
Also, by the time he came up to play with Erdy having 2 home runs, the outfielders, the corner outfielders, were standing about a foot off the warning track.
Yeah, stepping
pretty much
from
just,
the warning
pretty
track.
Pretty much just waiting to get the best view of the home run going over their heads.
Right, not the center fielder. He was playing only 375 feet away. But, like, the right and left fielders, the left fielder was shifted a little bit to the gap, but they were both playing, like, 2 steps in from the warning track. The kid is a remarkable power hitter, and he's going to hit a ton of home runs here. The only flaw in his game is that he's not selective enough at the plate. He doesn't strike out. He strikes out, like, the least amount on the team. I think he only has 10 strikeouts so far in the season.
Yeah, he's only got 10 strikeouts, right. And it's the best out of the people who are
right.
Regular hitters.
But, like, if you look at his average, it's up around, like, 365 now, and his
363.
363, and his OBP is just under 400. So you can see that he's not drawing walks. Like, but I think the problem is, not a problem, but when he swings, he doesn't swing and miss, as evidenced by the number of strikeouts. So he's going to put the ball in play even if it's not a good pitch. So I think as he develops a better plate discipline, he's just going to start hitting more for power because he's going to go up to the plate looking for his pitch, and he's going to take walks, and he's just going to become a legendary hitter here.
One of the big things, he has walked once in the last two, or, you know, once each game in the last two.
Right.
So it's starting to come around. Also, as he starts putting up more of these power numbers, the pitchers are going to try to stay away from him a little more, so he probably will start drawing a little bit more walks. But to me, while I've been raving about him the last couple of days when he's just gone crazy because he has now 6 home runs in the last 3 games, he's at 7 on the season, a lot of people have been saying, like, well, it's just against these, you know, lesser teams in the midweek games. Well, right now he's batting 372 against SEC opponents with only 2 home runs, which both came in one game, but he's got 16 RBIs, which has led the team in those games. So he has been hitting. The power is finally coming around, and he is a power hitter. So you're going to see those power numbers from the rest of the year.
And one last thing from the game before we kick it to McCall here is when after the game, you know, Bob and I were talking in the press box, and I was like, do you think he feels real nervous? Like, everyone expects him to hit a home run, like, every time, like, in that game. And Bob's like, oh, I don't know. And he looked real loose and stuff, and he had a big smile on his face while he's doing it. Obviously, it's fun to go do stuff like that. But, you know, just to see the different mindset in players afterwards, I asked him, you know, is there a little more pressure when you walk up there? There's 3 guys on base instead of, you know, bases empty, nobody out, and stuff like that. And he just smiled real big, and he said, well, you know what I've kind of figured out is that when the bases are loaded, the pitcher has to come to me. So there's a lot more pressure on the pitcher than there is on me. And you can just see how relaxed he is with the situation, that the kid has so much confidence that he's better than the pitcher. The pitcher's best pitch is not going to get him out. So he's going to have to attack the zone because he doesn't want to walk somebody. And Preston Tucker knows he's going to get a pitch to hit, and that's his attitude. He's just having fun, and that's great. That's what you want out of one of your best players.
One of the big things for me, though, and apparently Coach Solomon has raved about it now, is that for a left-handed hitter, he's very good against left-handed pitchers, which means you don't have to take his bat out of the lineup when a left-hander is throwing.
That's because he hits the ball to the opposite field so well, because a lot of times against lefties, you're going to get pitches that break away from you, and you're going to get them nibbling on the outside corner, get different angles and stuff. But because he's willing to let the pitch develop and get back on him and take the ball to left field, he's just that much better for it. He's not in there trying to pull everything. He's not trying to pull off-speed pitches away for power. He takes what's given, and he hits the ball where it's pitched.
All right, I hate to break up the love fest. I wanted to get into, I know before the year you guys talked about how he's like the next Matt LaPorta. He's going to be like Matt LaPorta here. I was very hesitant to jump on board with that, and even going into, I guess, Tuesday when I was covering the game with you guys, oh, how many home runs your boy got? Four? Oh, that's real cute. Or three at the time, I guess.
No, he had four, yeah.
Well, he
oh, going into the game.
So going
into
the game, he had three. I was like, oh, wow, three home runs. That's real big time. He's an ex-Malaporta. And then last night during the game, Bobby's texting me going, pull up game tracker and look at what just happened. I was like, oh, no, grand slam Preston Tucker. And then one inning later, he texts me and he goes, go look on game tracker. And it's three-run home run. Preston Tucker, and then he's like, you're not going to believe it. He calls me hysterically laughing. Like, I can't believe it. And then I look it up and he had another grand slam. So I didn't see it with my own eyes, but I'm starting to become sold on Preston Tucker. And
yeah.
I just want to do a little comparison here between him and Matt LaPorta of his freshman year. Right now, Preston Tucker, well, I'll start with Matt LaPorta. His freshman year, he played in 50 games, which was less than, I guess, 65 is what they played as a team.
Mm-hmm.
He only played in 50 games, only started 36 of them. His batting average was .285, which was eighth best on the team, I believe. Not too hot. He had 14 home runs, 37 RBI, slugging percentage of .646, on-base percentage of .371. I think Tucker's actually fairly comparable at this point. He's hitting .363, which is really good. Coincidentally, he's the only Florida player with a batting average higher than East Carolina's team average, which is .355. So just to keep that in perspective, what a real baseball team would be doing. And Tucker's had 30, he's played in 30 games, started 25. He's had 102 at-bats, which is only 28 less than what LaPorta had his freshman year. He's hitting .363, slugging percentage .667, on-base percentage of .393, 7 home runs, 39 RBI.
Well, I'm not going to address the ECU stuff at all. You can have that. But as far as the Preston Tucker versus LaPorta thing, after he hit the first Grand Slam yesterday's game, Bobby also pulled up LaPorta's numbers and was showing it to me. And I was like, he's like, oh, you know, he can definitely get to 14 home runs. Like, his home run totals are going to be comparable for his freshman year. And I was like, well, he's only had a LaPorta only had 130 at-bats, and Tucker's at, like, 100 already right now. So I was like, Bob, he's got to hit 10 in the next 30 at-bats. It's not going to happen. Well, he went 2-for-2 in his at-bats after that, so maybe it will. But I think, and this is going to draw, but O'Sullivan backed me up on this, although he didn't coach LaPorta as a freshman, but this will draw ire maybe from people listening to this. He is by far a more complete hitter at the same stage than LaPorta was. LaPorta had twice as much power, maybe. I don't know. LaPorta was an insane power guy. But Preston Tucker hits the ball the opposite field. He hits for average. He hit 100-point high. And I know LaPorta had a year where he hit 400 here right before he went to the draft. But, you know, that was because guys wouldn't pitch to him anymore. And, you know, he became more disciplined as he went along. But I'm just saying, as a freshman where they're at right now, Preston Tucker is ahead of LaPorta as a complete hitter. And O'Sullivan actually said yesterday he's the most advanced freshman hitter that he's ever seen.
One of the things is I feel as though with LaPorta, he probably had always had the power numbers. From the beginning, he was hitting for power. Whereas Tucker seemed to really get into the groove and start hitting the pitches, really starting to go opposite. You saw him, you know, early in the season starting to go opposite field, but he still wasn't hitting for power. And I think he's gotten to the point where he's so comfortable at the plate and he knows that he can actually hit these guys, that he now is then his swing go, and he's driving the ball much further, and those power numbers are just going to keep going up.
But do you think, in the Tucker-LaPorta debate,
mm-hmm.
if Preston Tucker is a more complete hitter than Matt LaPorta, but he doesn't reach the power numbers, would he be remembered as prolific of a hitter as Matt LaPorta? Because people want to see home runs, and they want to...
Well, that's an excellent question, and I think that he will hit as many home runs as LaPorta as time goes forward here. But maybe in this season, he's going to get to about the same number, but he's going to have way more playing time. So, like, the power numbers aren't really fair there. But I think by the time he leaves here, he may have just as many career home runs as LaPorta did. And I don't know. It's a good question. It's kind of like the Matt Dendecker question. Matt Dendecker's a big-time prospect, and he's a great player, but he's not going to hit a ton of home runs. He's a complete player, and he's not going to be remembered the same way that some of these other guys were.
Yeah, and the big thing for LaPorta was his sophomore year. He went up from starting 36 games to starting 70. His batting average went from .285 to .328. He almost doubled his home run total, going from 14 to 26,
mm-hmm.
and his RBIs went from 37 to 79. So
yeah, I mean, but like Preston Tucker can hit .326 at the college level in his sleep. Like it's not even hard for him. His career average should be way above LaPorta, and then LaPorta took a big step back in his junior year, partially due to injury. So, you know, I think their career numbers, I wouldn't be surprised if Tucker put up better career numbers. But Matt LaPorta is a great hitter, and I think he's going to be a good major league player, too. So will Preston Tucker be able to do that? I don't know. It's too early to tell.
Preston Tucker is also, you know, he's very unimposing. Like,
oh, God.
He's probably 5'11". Maybe he's listed at 6 feet or so. not a very big, like, bulky guy. He's got huge, huge forearms. I'll say that much. Enormous forearms. But you don't see this big power guy coming from him, whereas Laporta was that big power.
Yeah, when I get a column, I'm probably going to nickname him Popeye, because his arms, like, the forearms are just that big, and, like, I don't know, he's not imposing at all. I'm at eye level with him, and I'm not a tall guy. I'm, like, 5'10", and he's not a huge dude. Like, he's well put together, but he's just not. So it's impressive that he can hit the ball 450 feet at will, almost.
I was very surprised. The only time I've talked to him or, like, really been up close with him was after that Florida State fiasco in Jacksonville. Where the game got rained out, and we were waiting, people were just popping out, and we only got to talk to him, I guess. And he was talking. I didn't know who it was because I came in late. Mm-hmm. I'm listening, and then someone goes, "Preston," like, whatever. I was like, "That's Preston Tucker? Preston Tucker, the home run king?"
Yeah, you're a head, you're a head taller than him. You're a full head taller than him easily. Yeah,
I was taller than him. I was trying to figure out if it was Jericho Weitzel or who it was. Like, I knew it wasn't Mike Mooney.
Right, because he looks like he should be playing the middle infielder, but middle infield spots. But instead, he's a first baseman with just a ridiculous amount of power.
How is he defensively compared to Laporta?
This is – he's played – I'm pretty sure outfield and probably DH throughout most of high school. So this is his first season ever playing first base. So, and for someone who's never played, he's looked good. I mean, he hasn't done anything amazing. He hasn't, but he hasn't made huge mistakes either.
The way he hits, it doesn't matter. You can hide him. Like, he's definitely not, like, a huge liability, and he's getting better, and he's not terrible at first base by any means. But as long as the guys that you can hide on the field, you can hide them at first base, you can hide them at the corner outfield positions. So as long as he can play, as long as he can hit, like, one of those guys that you're hiding, which certainly he can, then you're good. The problem is you can't hide a guy like Clayton Pisani or somebody else who's struggling with defense, Jericho Weitzel or something like that, at one of those positions because they don't provide the offense you need out of those positions.
Why is – I think I missed this. I wasn't there for the games when this happened. Why is he playing first base and MacArthur DHing? I know MacArthur isn't like a natural first baseman by any means.
Well, MacArthur played third base in this last game, and MacArthur's deal, I think he's just worn down. If you look at him, I mean, he's a great hitter. He's a great contact hitter. He hits for a high average. But when you watch him run, and he's had a couple injuries, or a couple issues with his hamstring this season, MacArthur's, he's got a lot of wear on him. He's got a lot of mileage on the tires. And I think if O'Sullivan can get him in the lineup where he doesn't have to play the field, that's better for MacArthur. It's not that they're upgrading the defense there. I think they're just saving MacArthur.
I agree. Also, the infield has just played so poorly that having him at third base isn't too much of a liability, and I can get a better bat in the lineup than Pisani or Weitzel. Right. So that's usually why he's at third base, and DH is because he also he tweaked his hamstring a little while ago, and just between that, the ACL, and every other injury, I think he's just – they need to save him.
Yeah, and one more point that kind of speaks to the fact that I think the DH move is for MacArthur, not for Tucker, is that Teddy Foster, who's been a catcher predominantly in his time here, has been playing some first base for them recently, and I think that's just because they're trying to get MacArthur. I think Teddy Foster's a particularly great defensive first baseman, so and that's no knock on Ted. He's not a bad player. I'm just saying they're not making the move to Teddy for defense. So O'Sullivan loves to mix it up, and like he'll go with a thousand different lineups. I wouldn't be surprised if by then, if Tucker's time here, he kind of learns to play left field. I could see him doing that. But we'll see what it turns out to. As long as he hits the way he's hitting, he can play whatever position he wants.
All right, we're going to move on here into a quick little basketball roundup. We got three quick stories related to the world of college basketball here. McCall, start us off with this little thing about Deshaun Painter.
Yeah, apparently Deshaun Painter, who's already signed the letter of intent to play for Florida, wants to leave. He wants to back out of his letter of intent and go somewhere else. And the reason why this is significant is if Nick Calathes were to come back, Florida would be one scholarship over the limit, counting Painter and the other two commits they have. So if he's backing out and Florida's going to release him from their scholarship, maybe it means they already know Calathes is coming back, he's not going to the NBA. Or it could also mean they know Calathes is gone and they want to get a guard instead of Painter, who's a center, I believe.
All right, and Bobby, let's talk a little about DeMarcus Cousins. We mentioned him on the last show, didn't know where he was going.
I just want to say one other thing about Calathes.
Go ahead.
This is a clear sign to me that Calathes is not going to go to the draft at all. I mean, he's testing the waters, which is okay. But I think clearly they expect him back, and that's why they don't have a spot for this kid, because he would be the 14th scholarship that they don't have. all the draft projections just don't have him being drafted, and I just don't think it's going to happen. So I think that's what this means.
The other thing that's significant, too, is if they're cutting this guy, if they're cutting Painter to keep room for Calathes, it means that all the speculation about Eloy Vargas or Alan Chaney leaving isn't true, and they're going to stay.
I thought I had a top 100 from Chad Ford right in front of me that I was going to be perfect. But I have to be an insider to see past pick number 20. So sorry, guys. I can tell you Calathes is not in the top 20 on Chad Ford's board, but I can't tell you beyond that.
All right, are we going to move on to this thing that I started asking?
Yes. Good. Get to that thing.
All right. Tell us about DeMarcus Cousins. We mentioned him on the last show about going to Kentucky following John Calipari.
Yeah, DeMarcus Cousins is a big-time center. I think ESPN has the fourth overall player. He committed to Memphis with Calipari, and there was rumors that he was going to decommit and go somewhere else, and he said he was going to go back to the teams that originally recruited him, which were, I think, Washington and Kansas State, but he announced that he's going to go follow Calipari to Kentucky. He, too, has not signed a letter of intent. He's only got a couple more weeks to do it, but I'm sure at this point it's pretty set in stone.
Yeah,
he's going to Kentucky.
That's a done deal.
Will he make an immediate impact there following
them? Yeah,
absolutely.
All right, let's move on to that last basketball topic. Kyle, a former women's basketball player in the news today. Tell us about that.
Shea Brooks was drafted in the third round of the WNBA draft by the, I was going to say Phoenix Suns, but that's obviously not right, the Phoenix Mercury. And she got used, I think, with their second pick in that round or something like that. But I didn't even know there were three rounds in the WNBA draft until this transpired. Bobby had to inform me. I don't know what else to say about this. I was a little surprised she got drafted at all, but that's great. Good for her.
Absolutely.
Marche Dotson, nowhere to be found, though.
Also, I'm very upset because I looked at the – I remember doing this last year, and I completely forgot because I surprisingly don't pay attention to women's basketball, especially professional level. But there are six teams, I think, in the East and seven in the West. I don't know how you have an unbalanced league like that. It's very upsetting to me.
Well, there's only one playoff system. I think it's like the top six teams or the top eight teams, whatever it is,
something
out of
like
the
that.
13 make it. It's not like conference based.
So it's kind of like Little League, every team makes the playoffs.
No.
You got consolation trophies.
No, it's not like that, Mike DeFerdinand. making the jump in my argument. No, it's just like there's 13 teams in the top eight of all overall will make it.
Yeah.
All right. You have participation trophies. Like,
that's the most WNBA talk.
They can't afford participation trophies.
That's a good point.
Well, I'm sure they can get the plastic ones.
Oh, wow. And that is absolutely the most WNBA talk we have had and probably will ever have on this show.
Hopefully.
Let's make an oath. Right now, we will never surpass that WNBA talk.
Roughly 1 minute. We will never surpass that. All right, let's move on real quick to some reader mail we've gotten in the last week. Andy Hutchins sent us an email commenting on the stuff we talked about Courtney Paris, I think a week ago. I believe.
Mm-hmm.
He said he thinks Blake Griffin, recently declared for the NBA draft, should pay Courtney Paris a scholarship and that he will have more than enough money. And he was proved correct when Blake Griffin declared for the draft. So what do we think about that? Kyle, you really like that.
Yeah, I really like that a lot. And I think that's really sweet. I hope that happens. Like, I don't know what the chances are of that happening. Probably not very good. But she's going to have a heck of a time coming up with the money because WNBA is about to fold. There was something about how they can't even pay their players maybe this year. What were you telling me?
They probably aren't going to be able to sign all the first round picks.
Wow.
One of which was Courtney Paris. So
yeah.
maybe she'll get a you know enough salary over the next 2, 3, 4 years maybe to pay that.
And you guys all know
the
WNBA players, pretty much all of them play overseas in the off season, so they do like double duty because they obviously don't get paid enough here. And I don't know. Nobody's going to expect her to pay back the money, so I don't think that money will ever be paid back. But what a great gesture that would be if Blake Griffin were to do that.
Absolutely. All right, and then our other piece of reader mail here from loyal listener Vince Faniola. He responded with yet another Tebow moment. I'm going to read through this right here. He said he was at the Florida-UMass game at the NIT Final Four last year, and before the game, everyone was crowded together in a hallway waiting to be led to their seats. And the UMass fans, who were all excited to be there, were chanting and carrying on and all that. And then the one Florida chant that broke out among, and I quote, "us shameful and disgraceful Florida Gator basketball fans," they came back with, "we got Tebow, we got Tebow." And Vince ended the email with, "unfortunately, Tebow isn't on the basketball team."
That's an incredible one. That's a very good one from Vince. There's so many things wrong with that chant. I don't know where to start. I mean, you got the cross-sport thing, first of all. Yeah, the fact that UMass doesn't play football, especially not against Florida, probably like D3 or whatever they are over there. So they're not even caring about football whatsoever. The fact that I don't even know. There's so many things wrong with that that it just makes another great Tebow moment.
This really does not have to do with Tebow. It kind of reminded me after the 2007 football season when UF went to Georgia to play basketball and won, the crowd at Georgia started chanting, "What about football?" Which is just, it's a completely different sport. I don't know why people like to, you know, go back to something they did better.
All right, and I think we're done with the reader mail, though. Keep sending it in if you have anything to comment on, you know, your crazy Tebow moment or anything we've talked about in this or any previous show. We will read it on air. And now we're going to move into our last thing, our weekly awards, our Reggie Nelson Awards for Excellence in the Field of Sport and our Kyle Jackson Bad Angles of the Week. McCall, start us off with your awards.
Okay, my Reggie Nelson should be pretty obvious. It's going to the University of North Carolina Tar Heels for winning the national championship in basketball, not only because it made me deeply, deeply happy as a Carolina fan, but also because it may or may not have won me money in a bracket pool that may or may not have paid my way to an MLS game this summer to see the Seattle Sounders play along with Mike DeFerdinando. I'd like to give ourselves a pat on the back for that as well. my Kyle Jackson. I'm going really far off the board for this, but I found this to be pretty appalling. In a Serbian soccer game, I guess yesterday in Belgrade, this huge rivalry, apparently Partizan and Zvezda, Z-V-E-Z-D-A. Partizan won 2-0, and then Zvezda's fans responded, as any upset fans would, by lighting the stadium seats on fire, causing, I'm not sure exactly how much damage yet, but 51 people were arrested. There's all kinds of crazy videos and pictures on the internet. You should go check that out. So that's my Kyle Jackson, because that's just totally uncalled for.
Yeah, that's well deserved.
Yeah. All right, say Americans are out of control. Goodness. All right. We like to have a lot of fun on this show, and we like to joke around and make fun at things. But I'm going to be very serious for a moment here. I'm going to actually give out my Kyle Jackson first. And I woke up this morning at approximately like 11 o'clock. I had to be on the SEC coaches press conference. Teleconference, rather, that they do weekly, and that started at about 11:35. Right as I get on the teleconference at about 11:34, because I'm that responsible, I, of course, mute my TV, because I don't want that on the background, but I have SportsCenter on. And O'Sullivan was late getting on the phone. That's neither here nor there. But I glance over to the TV, and they have Nick Adenhart, and they have a pitcher for the Angels, and they have, like, a profile-type thing up there with some stats and, like, where he's from and stuff, and I saw he pitched well yesterday, so I was like, oh, cool, they're doing a little segment on Nick Adenhart. Might go pick him up for fantasy right now. Like, he's a big-time prospect, like, big future in baseball, and I had the TV on mute, so I didn't know what was going on. Went back to the teleconference looking at my computer for a second, and then I glanced back up, and there was, you know, big breaking news across the screen that Nick Adenhart had passed away overnight, hours after pitching phenomenally against the Oakland A's in a car crash. And the guy who hit him, whose name is not released to us because he'd be, I don't know, hunted down and tortured by people, rightfully so. You have his name?
It's Andrew Thomas Gallo. If you would read Deadspin, as I've so often said, he's 22 and he has a criminal record.
Okay, Andrew Thomas Gallo, I hope whatever they can do to this guy legally, they do to him, because it's suspected that he was driving drunk, first of all, which we never like to do. There's no reason why you should ever be driving drunk. And for him to run a red light the way he did, going as fast as he was, and hit a guy, it wasn't like a lapse in you know, concentration for a second where something bad just really happened. He plowed into their car, killed 3 people, and fled the scene afterwards. Mm-hmm. I hope whatever they can possibly give him illegally, he gets prosecuted to the full extent of the law, gets thrown in jail for as long as they can keep him there, because this is one of the saddest things I've ever seen. My jaw literally dropped while I was watching the TV. This kid's so young, he's such a big future in front of him, and it's just not right. He was not doing anything irresponsible for this to happen to him, because a lot of times you see athletes put themselves in compromising situations because they have so much money or they have friends that aren't good for them. He was just in a car with some friends and the victim of a tragedy. And I feel horrible for his family, and I hope they get through this okay. So that's my serious Kyle Jackson award. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I do know it's no Kyle Jackson.
Absolutely, my Kyle Jackson.
Do you have anything positive? Do you have
I was giving it, yeah, I have Reggie Nelson. Right. I was giving my Kyle Jackson two, right. What's the guy's name? Did we get it? Andrew Thompson Gallo. Okay. And my Reggie Nelson goes to the baseball season and fantasy baseball. One big happy family, because there's a deep hole that's empty in my heart where college sports used to be, now that football and basketball are completely done with. And I need something to occupy my time other than mid-major basketball. And baseball has done a lovely job stepping up and doing that. There's a lot going on. I have multiple fantasy teams, and I'm just glad it's baseball season again.
All right, Bobby.
My Reggie is going to be obvious. I'm going to take the, you know, I know everyone else wanted to, but I'll do it for everyone. My Reggie is obviously the Preston Tucker. We've already talked about him now.
For quite some time,
yes. My Kyle Jackson is actually going to be also Preston Tucker related. It's going to go to my colleagues Mike McCall and Evan Drexler, and also the Gainesville Suns writer who covers it with us, Edward Ashoff. All three of them before the season doubted me and Kyle's hype of Preston Tucker, and they have now all taken it back and are starting to be believers. For some reason, they're unwilling still to jump on the bandwagon, but they at least believe.
Get on the bandwagon now, because it's going to be moving too fast to jump on it next season. That's all I'm saying.
All right, and I guess I'm going to round it out here. I'm going far off the board for both of mine, actually. Nice. My Reggie is going to the Norway curling team. Several of us here have gotten involved in this whole streak for the cash thing for ESPN, and I have been known, especially by Evan, who just doubts my methods in this, to just pick whatever. I mean, you know, if my streak's dead, I'll just pick whatever's the first thing in the morning. And one day it happened to be Norway versus, who was it that
China.
Day? Norway versus China. And everybody's like, why are you picking Norway? And I just said, trust me. We wake up the next morning, Norway comes from behind to win.
No, that was Norway, United States.
Norway,
that's
U.S.,
like
that's right, because you were
Yeah, I was on the business end of that.
You're on the patriotic bandwagon.
Yeah.
Why would you hate your country? I picked Norway. I was correct. They came from behind to win that. So my Reggie goes to the Norway curling team. And my Kyle Jackson, even farther off the board, if that's possible, is going to YouTube user Ragtag Bag. Just to give people some background here, my lifelong dream to remake Journey's Separate Ways video. People close to me know this, right, Kyle?
It's true. I can confirm it.
All right, and we were looking at this the other night during the national championship game, which was so boring, such a blowout, that we went to YouTube during the middle of it. And, you know, I just figured I'd look that up, see if anybody's done it. Turns out this guy, Ragtag Bag, has done it virtually flawlessly. I have nowhere to go now. My lifelong goal has already been accomplished by somebody else.
I think you're looking at this the wrong way. First of all, he saved you from wasting a huge amount of time. And second of all...
Says the kid flying to Seattle for a Sounders game.
Second of all, you may have a soulmate here. I mean, you need to look into this. You need to contact this guy on YouTube. This could be a great friendship that could be forming. I can't imagine there are too many people with that ambition, so...
Well, probably not. Just me and probably this guy. So maybe I will look into it. Send him a message. And I guess that wraps it up for our show today. I've given quite a bit to listen to, quite a bit to digest there. Send any feedback to sports@alligator.org. Comment on our blogs. Anything you got to say about this show, any shows we've done in the past. And thanks for listening.
Good night, Vince.